also in the zoological world, it even plays out in like the most ideal human faces, the ones we find most beautiful.
Are we recording?
Here we are. It's like it never even happened.
All right. So it turns out that the DNA tends to select the Fibonacci series because it's a pattern that fits the grain of nature in such a way that it fosters survival. Now, here's another thing about evolution we're going to talk about some more later tonight. Everything wants to survive. Now, that might seem obvious because anything that didn't want to survive wouldn't survive. But the fact that everything is willing to struggle, and that's our topic for tonight, struggle, pain, and death, and the goodness of creation. Why does everything struggle to survive, to get food, to get mates, to get their mates, in, to get their children into the next generation? Because life is valuable and every living thing knows it. They don't know it the same way you and I know it. We know it with our minds, we know it with our hearts, we know it with our souls. They just know it. They just know it instinctively. And anything that didn't know it wouldn't be here. So there's a great value in struggle, and there's even value in pain, and there's even a kind of a value in death, which we'll look at. That's where we're going tonight, to take on one of the toughest questions. Linda.
Okay, so I understand the whole, when you look at it with number of the Fibonacci, but what do you mean when you say it repeats and everything?
You see it in sunflowers. You see it in the...
In the pattern
of the sunflower. Now. In the sunflower,
I remember that.
Okay.
But then in a person's face.
But it packs. It packs. It's like there's an angle. It's 137.5 degrees of rotation. And when those seeds are forming in the sunflower, when they're first popping up, if they go at 137.5, which is the angle that corresponds to the Fibonacci series, then you get a row that's clockwise, and then you get the next row counterclockwise, and it keeps alternating. That doubles the amount of seeds, which doubles the chances of survival for the plant and passing on its genes. Okay, so that's where it happens there. Then in the human face or in human teeth, they're strong teeth, and it's also attractiveness. We'd have to talk about it further, but it's not entirely true that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You've all heard that. Mm-hmm. But biologists don't believe that, and mathematicians don't believe that, and physicists don't believe that. They think that there's a mental beauty, and they think there's a pattern beauty. And there's even a physical beauty that is found to be cross-cultural, not just, you know, for... Minnesota people, but for it would be true in Asia and Africa as well. There are certain ratios of shoulders to hips in men and in women that are inherently attractive, and others that are somewhat off-putting. That's just the way it works cross-culturally that way. Linda, did I ever get to your question? Okay, good. If anybody else have anything that they're stumped on at the moment. Well, good. Then let's go to the next point, which is the big one. The divine design is not something that God just did a long time ago and was sitting at like a draftsman's table and working out what an elephant looks like and what a mosquito looks like and what bacteria look like and what human beings look like. That's a kind of a micromanager, almost silly picture of God. The divine design is actually superior to the old idea of design because it's a design of a living creation. Creation is alive, and we're inside this life. So the life of creation is participating in its design. That's through evolution. And now we've made the jujitsu move where we're trying to turn the challenge to our advantage. If you look at evolution from this angle, it actually makes the divine creation, the divine design, the intelligent design of creation look even better than a kind of a static design. This is dynamic design. And you and I are in it. We are part of the creativity of creation. It's ongoing. And there are bumps and bruises, which we'll get to in a few minutes. That's really tonight's topic, but we're working our way up to it. So this kind of design, the notion that the design is creative, ongoing, and that creation is participating in its own design, fits both current biology and the sheer treasure of human freedom. The one thing we have to have is freedom, or our lives don't mean anything. If everything is programmed, predetermined, there's nothing for you and me to do except follow the program. Or hope we're on the right side of it. If everything is completely chaotic and unpatterned, life would make no sense. What we actually have is a beautiful golden mean between them. So the design we have is beautiful, and it produces not only biological beauty, but also the beauty of human souls who are trying to find God. Last point, natural selection works on lower levels. And it teaches us about parallels on higher levels. One of the most important things that we can do as Christian thinkers is to think that reality is not flat. There are many levels of reality. So you're going to find things on the natural level, on the level of physics, chemistry, and biology, that are interesting. And it may be tough, but we don't live entirely on that level. If we did live entirely on that level, there would be no reason to have anything like church, Bible, and so forth. So we have to learn to solve problems, and natural selection, that's what it insists upon. Any creature that doesn't find a way to solve the problems, it's pretty tough. You lose. You're gone. So it's a message. Don't be lazy. Don't be complacent. Take what you've been given, protect it, nourish it, and grow it. Get better at it. We have to learn to win, the same way animals who survive have to learn to win. Now, the ultimate win is eternal life. And the way we win that is not on our own steam. It's what God does for us. I have no idea how to resurrect myself from the dead. But we follow someone who does know how to do that. So we're making switches here because we're not playing by the same rules of the natural world. We're getting help. That's called grace. And we have no real hope if we don't have grace. So natural selection produces bigger brains, and it does that by having babies born 11 or 12 months premature. And that also fosters the attachment of mother and child. And so you say, oh my gosh, we can explain everything through natural selection. No, we can't. These are lower level necessities, but they are wonderfully helpful for the higher necessities for the life of faith. If you don't have a brain, If your brain's not working at all, or if you're just hopelessly limited in if you have the brain of, say, a cat or a dog, how are you going to have a life of faith in God? How are you ever going to understand? So the lower level is entirely compatible with the higher level and with the God of love. That's what I've been laboring to show, and we've gone very quickly through all these things, but we'll have time for questions as we go. Let's get into tonight's challenge, which is, why is there so much struggle, pain, and death everywhere we see. And we're going to turn them, these three, to theological advantage. Well, first, let me show you. Is this speaker in the way?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Oh, let's see what happens.
Yes. Your helper's coming.
If I break it, it'll be someone else's fault. All right, is it over there? Perfect.
Yeah, that's good.
All right, there we go.
Yeah. All right, so there are three ancient gotcha questions in philosophy, and here they are. Most recently, they were written by the Scottish philosopher David Hume, but they were really, Hume was really quoting Epicurus from long, long ago. And there's the three questions, and it's kind of like when a reporter's trying to pin a politician down or something, and they get the gotcha on them, and they catch them in a contradiction. So here's the challenge that people ask of people of faith. Well, you see, is God able to prevent evil? If so, unable. If so, if God can't prevent evil, then God's not all-powerful. Is God unwilling? If so, then he's not all good. And if God's both able to prevent evil, all evil, and unwilling to do it, then why is there evil? Now, those questions have been around about 2,300 years. So they're not new. But what is new is that evolution has exacerbated the questions. It's made them worse. It's made them with a little more edge and a punch. So that's our work tonight, is to answer those questions. Well, here's the first attempt to answer. Progress can emerge from struggle. And all of evolution is struggling. It's not a 24/7 struggle. You know, animals play, they have a good time. You've seen, you know, newborns running around chasing each other. They romp, I'm quite sure that birds enjoy flying and singing, and squirrels enjoy leaping across the branches. And so, you know, nature is full of all kinds of pleasures and enjoyments for animals as well as for us. Now, there is struggle, pain, and death, but it's not a constant, dreary, horrible thing. Nature's really pretty good. Most of the time, for most of the ones in it. Okay, so let's talk about the purpose of struggle. Oh, sorry. Well, first of all, struggle has brought about development. There we see the picture I used earlier of a single-celled bacteria. That's the way all biologists believe that life began. Now, a single-celled bacterium is an extremely complicated entity. That's already a major accomplishment. But life doesn't stop there. My goodness, the story they're telling is a magnificent story. They're going from them to people who study those organisms. And there on your left is Simon Conway Morris, and he's up on the Burgess Shale in the Canadian Rockies, which was the site of the greatest fossil find perhaps ever in human history. We'll talk about that a little bit later tonight because it was very significant, and that's where he became the world famous biologist that he is. Competition spurs development. Now, you remember when we read the parable of the talents a few weeks back? That's about development. That's about taking the talent you've been given and developing it. And the one who doesn't develop it at all buries his one talent. Okay, what happens to him? What's that?
Died.
Well, yeah, he's thrown into the outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And the ones who do develop it, what happens?
More.
They're given more. They're like giving a promotion in a sense. They're given, the master says, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in a little. I'll put you over many things on a much higher level. So here you see on the left, you see a bat, which is a remarkable animal to be able to do what it does. It's called echolocation, where it can find insects flying at night. And it does it by a kind of a radar. It's almost like a radar or a sonar, really. There you see in the middle the sonar. And these are developments, but even in the human sense, we developed these things during the wars. They were developed during times of conflict. It would have been better not to have the wars, but even those things bring about conflict. Okay, here's the Cambrian explosion. This is the period in biology that Simon Conway Morris made his focus in his own and cut his biological teeth on this. Now, this period was so important because up till this time, for a couple billion years, all you had was bacteria, basically. Very, very simple creatures. And then, in the Cambrian, something just took off. And it took off all of a sudden, in a relatively short time. A million years, remember, is almost nothing to a geologist and to these paleobiologists. So what made it happen is kind of scary. Animals started to eat each other. Now, if you want to eat another animal, you got to catch it. And if you want to catch it, you have to have some kind of structural system that can make you move faster than the prey. And if you are the intended prey and you don't want to get eaten, and you have to have some system that will let you go faster than the predator. So the whole system just takes off, and you get all of these systems for the first time during the Cambrian. It's just, they're not there, and then all of a sudden they're there. That's what was found up on those Canadian Rockies at the Burgess Shale. So you get skin and sensory systems. Because if you're going to have structures, you have to have something that holds the structure, skin. You have digestive tracts and structures, muscular and circulatory systems. So you got the heart comes in. All of these things are found in those kind of strange-looking creatures. Almost all of which, virtually every one of those is now extinct. But their fossils have been found, and this is an artistic reconstruction, but it's accurate. Internal organs, kidneys, livers, those sort of things, respiratory systems. It's really a magnificent and beautiful development. Do you see its beauty? To go from a single-celled bacteria to those kind of creatures. And also, I should point out, notice, it's all underwater. The Canadian Rockies were all under the ocean. Remember when I told you that, I think, 750 million years ago, England was near the South Pole, and Japan didn't exist. It's moving. We're part of a dynamic reality. It's not sitting still. It looks like it's sitting still, but so does the hour hand of a clock. Okay, now creation is really left in an unfinished state, and it's left in an unfinished state for a reason, a beautiful reason. And here you see an ancient saying of Hesiod, quoted by Plato, the gods have put sweat between us and virtue. So if you want virtue, you can't just show up and say, I want virtue. It's a matter of sweat. And it's not just a matter of physical sweat. That's part of it, an important part of it. It's also a matter of mental sweat. It's even a matter of spiritual sweat. the development that Christ calls for in the parable of the talents, if it was that easy to do it. We'd all just be there and could sit around and congratulate each other. Two requirements about reality. The reality we find has to be sufficiently difficult, challenging, that it motivates our efforts to do something about it. But the second thing is, it can't be impossible, or there'd be no point trying, and we couldn't win even if we tried. So if you do the right thing, it has to respond. Now here's the point I want to come back to, our old buddy Logos. You have the Logos of God that is the that is there in the creation, and everything created goes through this Logos. But you also have the Logos in the human mind, in the sense that is the human mind. So the Logos of the human mind can discover the Logos inside the fabric of created things. And that happens every time you fix your lawnmower, yeah, or you figure out how to knit a pattern if you're making a sweater, or solve an engineering problem, or any time you solve a problem, that's Logos. Every time you come to an understanding, that's your Logos, understanding the Logos of creation. Which gets complicated among human beings, because we do these societal and cultural things. We don't just do biology. So reality has to respond to our intelligent efforts, and when we get it right, we know it's right because it talks back. All right, John Locke, famous English philosopher of the 1600s, towards the late 1600s especially, very influential on our founding fathers in America. But he wrote about property. He said, if you come across a field of strawberries that's just growing there in nature, like these, you can pick them. And nature will give you a little bit. And it just does that. Nature just does it. You can find stuff as you're walking along, and you find it, and you just pick it and eat it and go on your way. But we don't just do that. We're human beings, and we don't just live in biology. We live in our own created culture. So we can cultivate fields of strawberries, grow hundreds of thousands, millions of strawberries, and we can market them. We can get enough for our own family. We can get enough to sell. We can get industry going this way. This is what we're capable of by using Logos. So we take the field and we improve it by factors of hundreds. That's really something good about us. That's why I personally hate it when people say, well, she's only human. I think it's a great privilege to be human and to be part of this kind of struggle, to make things better, to take what you've been given, a field that's just kind of okay, and turn it into that. There's our old friend, the butterfly. And we talked about the accomplishment of learning to swim. First of all, we're not naturally swimmers. You've seen the terror that 5-year-old kids have when they first get in the water. You know, don't let me go, don't let go. You know, you've seen that. But you can be trained like this guy. But again, to remind you, it's not just him. It's the teachers he had. That's part of what we do, culture. It's that cap he's wearing. A Speedo cap actually makes him swim faster because there's less, the goggles, the chlorinated water to keep it clean, the swim pool. The many, many times parents drove that young guy to his various lessons. That's culture. It's family and culture. That's what we do. We're not just stuck in the biological world. We're always in it. We never get out of the biological world, but we're more than biology. So this is why an unfinished creation is part of God's gift to us. It gives us a place. It gives us a purpose. It gives us value, and it lets us add value to what's there. We have a perfect and infinite God. That's not us. We're imperfect, finite, and incomplete. So what do we need, given that asymmetry between the God we're in relationship with and the human status we actually have? Well, we need an unfinished creation. We need a place that will respond to our intelligent efforts, and we get it. This is why evolution is actually an advantage for faith, not ultimately a disadvantage. And then Jesus' parables, you remember, one got five, one got two, one got one. The guy who had five doubled it, ended up with 10. The one who had two doubled it, got four. The one who had one buried it in the ground. Bad strategy. Okay, let's talk about death, which is the scariest part of life in nature. And when we say nature, let's pause for a moment. Well, what's the difference between nature and creation? And the answer might be that they weigh the same. They both have 10 to the 80th number of protons. They have same number of stars, galaxies. So in one sense, you could talk about nature and you could talk about creation. But I think a Christian should always talk about creation, because creation implies creator, it implies purpose, it implies goal of the very existence itself. There's a reason for the existence itself, and then there's a reason for all of our existence. In nature, you say, well, it's just nature, just happened, just kind of big old lucky accident. But I've said previously how silly, ultimately, I think that view is, which is called naturalism. All right, so what about death? What does death do? Well, first of all, it hurts. Nobody, we grieve even over when our pets die. We grieve when our friends, family die. Death is a hard thing. Well, the first thing is it's a warning. Imagine with me for a moment that there was no such thing as death. Could you imagine what your life would be like? I mean, as I'm thinking, especially, you know, I teach undergraduates. Friday night in a dormitory somewhere, it would just be a constant party and silly, because time would have no value. But the fact that everybody in this room knows we're going to die at some point, pretty close to 100% on that, means that your time is limited, that it's valuable, and now you have to do something that matters before you give the account to the master. So we're still talking about the parable of the talents, aren't we? Yeah, Nelson.
How does that tie in with heaven? You make it to heaven, you got all the time of eternity, and yet, even with that, God is going to give you something that matters. He's going to have you rule. He's going to make you ruler over his creation, his renewed creation. So, I don't understand how death is a positive, because it tells us time is limited, because we want to get to heaven where time is unlimited.
True. And that's one of the things that focuses the mind and says, you need to do something besides party. You need to do something besides just endless silliness and doing stuff that's trivial and that doesn't matter. You need to do something with your life. You need to wake up to who you are and where you are. But let me see if I answer it as we go on. It's a good question, but Nelson, that is the goal, is heaven. The goal is eternity. But I think death can become a teacher to people who otherwise never would give it a thought. I've seen people like that. I've been at funerals where people who never had a thought besides the next sale at Macy's, you know, when somebody in the family died, their mind was focused. They were thinking. They wanted to know what's the all of a sudden they were willing to have a real conversation. So that's the first thing death does. Secondly, it creates a common bond of every living thing, because every living thing in the biological world dies. Thirdly, Jesus now. Now this is almost like heaven, of course, coming to earth. Jesus enters into the democracy of death. He doesn't stand above it. So the Creator even comes in to experience death. When he becomes fully human in the incarnation, he doesn't shirk it. And it's not a very nice death, as we all know. But then, oh, go ahead.
I'm kind of hoping Nelson too. Time is limited to do something that matters. Isn't in Judaism, you die, but they really don't know what happens after that?
Okay. That's right, yeah. In the Old Testament, when people died, they went to a place called Sheol. And it was just kind of a shady place where people just slept. It wasn't a punishment.
But warning, time is limited to do something that matters, because the next step is Sheol.
Well,
if you haven't experienced Jesus.
Well, yeah, okay. Right. But that's a different conversation.
Right. But Nelson was saying, weren't you saying Nelson's like, well, why not die to go to heaven, right?
No, I guess what I'm saying is, if death on earth is a warning, time's limited, you better do something that matters. How does that translate to heaven, where time is unlimited? Does that mean we don't have to do something that matters when we're in heaven, and yet God is going to require of us, and when we're in heaven, that we be rulers over his creation?
I have no idea whether there's time in the next life. I have no idea if there's time, if there's some intermediate kind of context between time and eternity. It's sheer conjecture from my perspective. I just don't know what happens. I just want to be part of it. And any way God wants to do it is all right with me. It really is. The question is just, that is part of the purpose. But I think death, actually, that's that first point, that death alerts you. You need to think about what you're doing, because you're not going to be here forever. So where are you going to be? What are you going to be after you're dead? And, you know, you can answer that in several different ways. And all kinds of people have. But Jesus and the Catholic Church answers it in a very clear way. One of the most, the loveliest things and the welcome of Jesus' new teachings is clarity about eternal life. Okay, so resurrection, Jesus' resurrection, that gives us a cornerstone of hope. We're all going to die, but we're not going to die like people who don't have hope. It still hurts when people we love die. I hate it when people that are close to, we all hate just confronting death. But we don't grieve like those without hope. So, Linda, there's a difference. Now, again, stressing that we're more than biology. Darwin says, basically, the evolutionary teaching says, got to do everything you can to survive and see that your offspring survive, and there's fierce competition for resources and so on. Well, what does Jesus say? Well, let's see. Did I get it on the sheet? No, I didn't. It's Mark 8:35. Did I get it down there? I did not. Okay, Mark 8:35 goes like this. It's It's one, it may be my favorite verse in the entire Bible, if I have to pick one. And that is, whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever will lose his life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. The first time I came across that, I was going, wait a minute, I want to save my life. I want to save my life. Whoever will save his life will lose it. But whoever will lose his life, Jesus says, for his sake, for my sake, for the sake of the gospel, which is for the sake of other people, you'll get it. So it's a paradox, because if you try to save your life, you lose it. But if you're willing to lose your life for the right reason, not just because you got drunk and jumped off a roof somewhere, you got to lose it for the right reason, you gain it. So there's a losing side to the teaching, and there's a winning side to the teaching. But notice that how paradoxical it is, because you have to be willing to actually die in order to win. Now, most of the time, you're not going to have to die, and you only get to do that once anyway. But it might mean doing the dishes when you're tired and when everyone else is, or doing some task no one else will do. You just have to be willing to give up the self for the sake of the other and for Christ. Yes, please.
I've been reading a lot about near-death experiences, so I would kind of relate to that, because maybe they see, like, oh, wow, I wasn't doing so great, and then they come back to life, essentially, and then they change it so that they have and can lose it for the better, if you will. Right? Does that tie in?
Well, I'm fascinated by near-death experiences, too. You know, I used to think it was kind of silly, and then a friend of mine was writing on it, and he was a real kind of scientific guy, and he actually found all kinds of research, that empirical data that was supporting it. You know? And I'll tell you about that during break, if maybe you've seen it, too. But there's a guy in Atlanta, Dr. Sabom, I think is his name. Have you come across that?
No, I just hear about it on Relevant Radio, or I have a little devotional book with them in there.
YouTube.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. So, Jesus's teaching seems to be at loggerheads with Darwin's. Darwin says, save your life. Jesus says, lose your life. But notice that Jesus says, lose your life in order to gain your life. In order to gain eternal life. Don't lose your life for stupid. Lose your life for gloriously good stuff. For the sake of the gospel. For Jesus' sake. And also, the first rule of the natural law is, don't lose your life. Do everything you can to preserve your life. That's St. Thomas. The second principle of the natural law is, if your neighbor needs you, you must be willing to serve your neighbor and even die for your neighbor if necessary. But then the third principle that St. Thomas combines this with is, you must never do anything for the neighbor that would harm your own soul. So we're back to the eternal life. And Nelson, that's really where you started us with your first question was, it's different. I mean, we have a different goal than the other players in time and space. Our ultimate goal isn't about time and space. One of my favorite Old Testament quotations is from Deuteronomy, where God says, I have set before you life and death, therefore choose life. Now, animals choose life all the time, but when we choose it, it's different, because we have other possibilities. This is pro-life. This is affirming life. All right, and when you come back, we're going to talk about this, what's called theodicy. Just before break, I'll tell you this. Theodicy comes from two words, theos, which means God, and dike, which means righteousness. And so it's defending the righteousness of God, even though there's evil in the world. Well, let's take a few minutes. Let's take 5 or 10 minute break and chat with each other and You come back, we'll finish it.
Stop by.
Guys, you're listening.